Esther. Okay, in the end of Megillas Esther, Perek Tes, source number one, the Megillah is written, and the adjectives describing the Megillah are very intriguing, especially one. V'tichtov Esther Hamalka Bata Abichayel Mordechai Yehudi et kol tokef lekayim et igeret hapurim hazot hashinit. The Megillas Esther is described as an igeret, as a letter. What do you mean a letter? It should be described as a sefer. In fact, the pasuk I didn't quote, but it's in the end, it's v'tikasei b'sefer. In the end of Megillas Esther, I'll read you the pasuk out of the Tanakh. A little bit further on, in the end of Perek Tes, which is the perek that summarizes and institutionalizes all the halachos. Umamar Esther kiyam divrei ha'purim. This is Perek Tes, pasuk lamed bet. Ha'ilav v'nechtav b'sefer. So that's the normal expected term for Megillas Esther, to be a sefer. It's part of the canon, part of Tanakh. One of the 24 books, Sefer Torah. And yet this pasuk, which is a little bit earlier, two pasukim earlier in Chavtet, refers to it as an igeris, as a letter, which is much less formal, much more casual. You write a letter to someone. Today we don't write so many letters, but you get the drift. So Chazal sends this duality and this contrast. So the Gemara Megillah, Daf Yud Testament Aleph, source number two, quotes Rav. So some of his Talmidim quoted Rav. When he read this parak, he noticed the contrast. It says, Megillah nikrei sefer. On the one hand, it's referred to as a sefer. V'nikrei sigeris, and it's also referred to as a letter. So how can it be both? How can it be formal and informal? So Rav's compromise is, in fact, it's somewhere in the middle. It's somewhere in that mid-range zone. It doesn't have to be hyper-formal like a sefer Torah, but it should have a little formality to it, a little bit structure to it, unlike just the letter that someone would jostle off to their friend. So what's the balance? How do you reach that balance? Nikrei Sefer, Rav is focusing on the way that it's woven. Megillah is very rarely going to be written on one hide. It's difficult to imagine an animal that long that its entire skin could be used to write the Megillah. So it has to be several hides sewn together. So in a Sefer Torah, all the hides, all the skins, have to be sewn together with sinews of a kosher animal. They're called gidim. So you take the little sinews of a kosher animal and you tie them together. That's what you see on a Sefer Torah. So how do you sew together the hides upon which you write Megillas Esther? Does it have to be kosher animal sinews, or can it be synthetic? So that's really the compromise, the calibration. Rav says, Nikres Igeres, source number two, line two, Shim Tafra B'chute Pishtam Sul. I can't have completely synthetic binders. It has to be sewn with something natural and, of course, kosher. The Nikres Igeres, but on the other hand, it's called an Igeres, Shim Hitu Bashlosh Echute Gidim Ksher, as long as it has three. The whole Megillah doesn't have to be bound with kosher sinews, as long as it has three. Now, whether it's three per page or three per section, right now, that's the halachic conversation, which is less important. So, machlokas rishonim. But for our purposes, Rav noticed the clash between Sefer and Igeres. And Rav noticed that the word Igeres deformalizes the word Sefer in real halachic consequences, that I can employ synthetic fabric with synthetic strings to sew the Megillah together. The Ramban, in his parish to that sugya, elaborates and broadens this conversation that the deformalization of Megillah yields additional consequences, not just about the crafting of the Megillah and what types of sinews you employ. So the Ramban says, Ahani lan, source number three, Igeres, lahakil ba shloshechut egidim. On the one hand, the fact that it's called the Igeres allows us to have that leniency with only three kosher sinews. Okay. The kol shekein, here's, you see the Rishonim in action. You see the Ramban elaborating on the Gemara, which elaborates on the Pasuk. Line number three, source three, the kol shekein bidvarim shechutz legufei. Halachos that apply not to the actual crafting of the Megillah, but to the manner of recital. So for example, kagon kriya shela, how you read the Megillah, shedina bohem kedini geris, that you can treat the Megillah when you read it in a less formal fashion than you treat a Sefer Torah, namely in the manner that you treat a letter. Zeo Shishanino. So, for example, the Mishnah teaches us, Karetz Megillah, Omid V'yoshev Yatsa. First Mishnah in the third parak of Megillah, person reading the Megillah can be sitting. Person reading the Sefer Torah must be standing. First Mishnah again, Chafalaf in Megillah, Karetz Megillah, Omid V'yoshev Yatsa. The Gemara says immediately, Mashen ken b'Sefer Torah. The Sefer Torah must be read by someone standing. According to some shittos, even the people listening have to be standing. If you ever want to see Talmidim we'll be able to pick out Tamidim of Rabbi Soloveitchik in a minyan. Most of the time, the people standing tend to be Tamidim of Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's very, very makbir that the listener should be standing because we have to recreate Har Sinai. Because that's a machlokas, Tirdas and Shulchan Aruch, where they should be standing during Kriyas HaTorah. But it's only the reader has to stand, that's for sure. You can't sit down when you read from the Torah. But yet the reader from the Megillah, if he must, you don't have to, but most of our readers will stand, but if you need to, you can sit down. Machlokas, whether lechachila you should stand, we possibly you should stand, but if you have to, you can sit down. Because it's not safer, it's not formal, it's a letter. Just read it in a casual way, b'shech b'chov v'kumecha, as you'd like, as you are, in your leniency, in your own convenience. Number one. Number two, u'mikan ani omer. So now you see how Rishonim developed Gemaras. First, the Ramban quotes a Mishnah, which he associates with this concept. The concept is latent in the Pesukim. Rav develops the concept and applies it to the sinews. The Ramban says, oh, that's what the Mishnah means when it allows us to sit when we're reading the Megillah. Now the Ramban says, oh, based on all these facts, I'm going to now ad lib and give you other halachas that don't appear in any sources. So here's the Ramban creating halachas. You see the flow? Pasuk, Gemara, Mishnah, the Ramban associates with the Gemara, and now here's some of my own ideas that I think are true based on all this data. This is called induction. You loop together a couple of sources, you induce a concept, now that I have the concept, I can deduce other concepts, and it can apply to other ideas. So the Ramban says, Umikana Neomer, line number four, now it's me. Now it's not a Mishnah, it's not Rav, it's me. Umikana Neomer, the Ramban says, I therefore theorize, Shehakore Poshet Kigeres, Ve'eno Korech Kesefer Torah. You've seen the Megillah. We fold it like a letter rather than rolling it like a formal book. Velo kedivrei Rabbeinu Tzarfat, against those French rabbis who felt that you should roll the Megillah. You can go back to the 12th century to a shul in France, you'd see them reading the Megillah in a rolled up fashion. And one says, no, it's not a sefer, it's an igeris. Fold it, don't roll it. V'nagu hakol b'kriyasa, not only that, I'll tell you another minhag. Here you see also, it's so beautiful to read Rishonim. I'm going to defend the minhag. I've seen a minhag, the Ramban says, that when people read the Megillah, they're not that faithful to the grammar. They stop in the wrong place. They run all into sentences. They're very histrionic, theatrical. It's not like you're reading a Parshas Pekudei. So he says, V'nagu akol b'kriyasa, shelo lahafzik b'sof ha-psukim k'sefer Torah, el b'emtzon. Stop in the middle. You can read half-psukim. It's not this formal recital of sacred texts or of texts that are written in a sacred fashion, but more informal. V'hatam, sheminog igeres nogim b'kriyasa kimon shekasavta. Here's the Ramban, because we treat it like an igeres, and when we treat it like an igeres, you can read it informally. So now you see that this contrast between sefer and igeres is not just a one-trick pony. It applies to one halacha about the sinews. The Gemara only talked about the sinews, but there are other areas that igeres casts its influence on sefer. This is just a way for us to appreciate that a Megillah is not what we expect. Every one of the 23 other Svarim are Sefer. Sefer Tanakh, Sefer Yeshaya, Sefer Eov, Sefer Tehillim. The Megillah has a little bit of an Igeris in it. And in fact, I didn't quote all the Pesukim for you, the word Igeris is written 10 times in Megillah's Esther. So it's not just this Pasuk, but there are 10 letters that are sent. Anyone know the 10 letters? One of the 10 letters. Who's already read Megillah's Esther? Homework? I won't tell it to you. There are 10 letters in Megillah's Esther. I give you a hint. The letter that the man should rule the home, the letter against the Jews, the letter repealing, the letter to the people in open cities, closed cities, the final letter. Just see if you can find the 10 letters that are sent in Megillah's Esther. So there's a lot of letter writing. And in fact, okay, it's just a lot of letter writing, but there are these interesting people in Megillah's Esther that seem to be robocops, mall police. they're just throw-ins. They're background music. And all of a sudden, they become the rock stars in Megillah's Esther, the letter writers. People who are writing letters. Source number four, I just quoted one of the pasuk, one of the letters, Ve'chtob b'shem ha-melech ha-chashverosh. This is the letter to repeal the decree, or to allow the Jews to defend themselves. Vayachtom b'tabas ha-melech. Vayishlach svarim b'yad haratzim. Basusim rochvei ha-rechesh. Ha-chashdranim b'nei ha-ramachim. It's almost satiric. such a big deal about postal workers carrying the letters. I mean, we know the letter to get from one place to the other place has to be carried by someone. So that's, it's implicit. It doesn't have to be stated. Yet every time a letter's out, there's a lot of drama about the Achashtranim b'nei Ramachim yatsumu v'olim b'dvar ha-melech v'ados nitna b'shushan abir Achashtranim b'nei. It even sounds like to be a letter writer slash carrier, you have to inherit it. Because you couldn't be an Achashtran unless you were b'nei Ramach. If your father was a Ramach, you could be an Achashtran. And you could upgrade to be a Ramach. And then your son could be an Achashtran. And if you weren't in these very, very socially static systems, you weren't able to rise to the celebrity of being a letter carrier. In fact, you think, I don't know who these letter carriers were? No one knows who they were. There's an interesting machlokas based on the Gemara, source 16 and 17. We'll go back. The Gemara says, okay, we'll start with source 15. Hakaris and Megillah and Mafreya lo yatsa. You can't read it backwards. Kar al peh, kar targum b'chalashon lo yatsa. You can't read it orally. Avol karanas ala laws az bilaz. You can read it in any language you want, French, Spanish, English. But there's one language that's universal, even if you don't understand. Bahaloes shashama shiris yatsa. If you're a loes speaker and you hear it in Hebrew, you're yatsa. So the Gemara is a little bit shocked. Source number 16, it's the ensuing Gemara. If I don't understand Hebrew, what's the purpose of hearing the Megillah in Hebrew? I don't understand it. Midi. Dahavi anashim v'amei aretz. We said, well, women and amei aretz don't understand it either. So in this case, even the man is like an amei aretz and women in those days. So somehow we're yotzei. Where does it really explain? Then the Gemara reinforces this point. Maskifla Ravina. Ravina tried to reinforce the point that even if you don't understand Hebrew, you don't say. He says, Maskifla Ravina, Ataranan, line number 2, source 16. Achashran and Benera Macha Miyadina. Does anyone know who these people were? We read these words countless times in Megillas Esther. Does anyone know who they really were? But we know the general gist. We know what's happening. We don't really know what the Achashranim were. We don't really know the Ramacha. We know they somehow facilitated letter deliveries. We don't really know. We're reading it and we're celebrating the Nes. Hachanami, if you don't understand Hebrew, if you have a basic sense of what's going on, you're celebrating the Nes by reading it. Mrs. Kriya Persuminisa. So Ravina selects this phrase as the prototypical phrase that no one knows what's going on. Everyone is baffled. Even the big Talmud Chacham doesn't know. So what difference does it make if you don't understand 5 words, Hachashan, and 4-3 words, and understand the whole Megillah? The basic gist of what's going on, you don't say. It just begs the question, who cares? If we don't know who they are anyway, why does Megillah constantly speak about them? Why is this important? So that's our discussion today. Who are the letter writers in Megillah Esther? Why they're important? Okay. I'm going to take a few giant steps back to get a little sense of when Megillah Esther occurs. I'm providing Nesperm. I'm providing Chazal's timeline, Rashi, in the beginning of Sefer Ezra. Doesn't necessarily stack up with archaeology. Let's just follow Chazal's timeline. Chazal's timeline, there's an 18-year gap between the initial destruction of Yerushalayim, when Yerushalayim is ransacked, Yoshio, and 18 years later, Sitkiah is finally exiled. In that first wave, Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Bavel, exiles most of the leadership, takes the young, up-and-coming leaders and imprisons them in the palace in Babel, but he doesn't want to torture them. He wants to train them to become Babylonian so they can facilitate the transition of the other Jews into Babylonian culture. There'll be this new vanguard helping the Jews get accustomed. What? Daniel is, of course, one of them. We'll talk about Daniel and Megillah a bit later. Okay? And 18 years later, of course, he finishes the job. Now, no one is really sure when the Gullus began. Because everyone knew that it was a 70-year Gullus. Yirmiyahu had been very explicit about that. But when do you start counting from? You start counting from the first wave, the second wave. 70 years after the first wave, a lot of tumult. The Babylonian Empire falls. Belshazzar, who was Nebuchadnezzar's successor, has a famous party where he sees the writing on the wall because he had drank wine from the Klei HaMikdash, and he becomes attacked by the Persians and Medians. I'll just shut this off. And then at that point, the entire kingdom transfers into Persian and Media. So the entire Babylonian kingdom falls apart almost overnight, which is an amazing, amazing moment in history. And then the Jews receive authorization from Koresh, one of those early Persian Median kings, to go back and rebuild the foundations of the Beis HaMikdash. So 70 years after the first wave, everyone thinks this is it. The Galus is over. They start building the Beis HaMikdash. Then the locals start to get very opposed to the Jewish settlers who are occupying our land. And they write letters back. They write letters of hatred back to Koresh. And in fact, interesting enough, Chazal say that some of the letter writers in that early stage before Purim were Haman's children. You ask yourself, why were Haman's children hung on the tree? Not just because they're Haman's children, because they were the people halting the construction of the Beis HaMikdash years before Purim. Okay? Now, the Jewish construction of the Beis HaMikdash is halted by the decree of Koresh. There are Jews living in Israel already during Purim, during the Nes Purim, but they're living under duress, they're living under stress, they're being attacked, the Beis HaMikdash is languishing, it's a very sad state. Basically, redemption has ground to a halt. We thought we had it, and everything is static. Everything is stagnant. 18 years later, Ezra and Nehemiah then bring the second wave of Jews, 44,000, 42,000 Jews, and the Beis HaMikdash is finally constructed. The Nes of Purim occurs somewhere in those 18 years. Not clear when, but the Jews have already returned. The foundations of the Mikdash have already been laid. However, it's a bit stagnant. And then Purim occurs, and then a couple years later, the Beis HaMikdash is reconstructed. You can't separate Purim from what's going on in terms of Jewish history in Galut and Gula. It's not just some little miracle that takes place in some far-off country. Now, what happened to the Jews? See, we live so far from the Mikdash and so far from sovereignty that when we suffer and mourn on Tisha B'Av, we think about the Kohen Gadol, we think about the Korbanos, we think about the Melech. Maybe in Israel, we're a little bit more organic and holistic. But they lost everything. It wasn't just the Beis HaMikdash. They lost nationhood. They lost national identity. They lost culture. They lost flood. They lost everything. Basically going from being one of the leading citizens of the ancient world to being basically a homeless refugee. And everything is lost. A part of culture that's lost is language. Language is your identity. Language is your culture. Language is whom you are. Remember the Jews in Egypt? Hazal were very, very critical of them. They fell into the deepest pits of paganism and moral disobedience, but they held on to three cultural markers. What were the three cultural markers? Name, clothing, and language. And that platform was enough to regenerate national identity when HaKadosh Baruch Hu interceded. So language is very iconic. And now that they've lost nationhood, they lost their ability to speak Hebrew. Why would you want to speak Hebrew anymore? When the Jews are no longer living in their land and the Beis HaMikdash is demolished and Judaism has been basically terminated by Nebuchadnezzar, why would you want to speak that ancient out there? Would anyone here want to study Anglo-Saxon? Anyone want to study ancient Gaelic? Maybe a couple of scholars in museums and academia, but why would you want to speak languages that are antiquated, that are obsolete? You get a sense of this in the two books that capture the spirit of the time. Daniel is written entirely in Aramaic, and the first six chapters of Ezra are written in Aramaic because no one's speaking Hebrew. So of course, this will be written in Aramaic because Jewish culture is abolished. Jewish culture has been emptied, has been vacated. So of course, everyone's going to write in Aramaic. And in some ways, ironically, the poster boy for this loss of language is none other than our good friend Mordechai. Because Mordechai's name isn't even Jewish. Marduk is a Persian god. And his name resonates with Marduki's, Marduki-esque resonance, Marduki-esque feel. And in fact, there's a fascinating Gemara that describes him and one of his nicknames. If you take a look at source number 7, okay, Mordechai had two nicknames. One nickname was Psachia. And this man, Psachia, or Mordechai, was in charge of collecting money for women's korbanos after they gave birth. Psachia al-Hakinim, source number 7. He collected the money. Zem Mordechai. Lama nikra shmo Psachia. Why was he called Psachia? Sheposeach devarim v'darshan v'yodeah b'shivim lashon. He was an expert in 70 languages. Where it says, wait a second, he was a member of Sanhedrin. All of Sanhedrin were experts in 70 languages. Where it says, no, there's a difference. Ella, last line, to have a bayal lishnei v'darish. He didn't just know different languages like every other member of the Sanhedrin, but he was able to mix the languages. He was able to speak a little bit Persian and then a line of Hebrew and then a line of Babylonian and then a line of... He was able to mix the languages, and that's why another one of his nicknames was not just Petachia, but in Nehemiah, he's referred to as Bilshan. Bilshan is one of the people that appears in Nehemiah on the way back. Chazal feel he's Mordechai. Why was he called Bilshan? Balal Lashonos. He mixed up all. So this is the poster boy. What's happening to Jewish identity? It's happening to Jewish languages. And the antithesis to Mordechai, the real hero of this entire period, there are two heroes, but I'll speak about the real hero, is Ezra HaSofer. Because when Ezra returns the Jewish people to Israel, he has to rebuild language. Just like when we returned 70 years ago, we had to develop the language we had lost. We had to modernize the Hebrew language, start to study the Hebrew language, start to popularize Hebrew. So Ezra realizes if they're returning, there's an entire generation or two that hasn't spoken Hebrew. But it's not just a generation or two, it's also the world's consciousness is essentially neglected Hebrew. So Ezra's very, very attentive to Jewish identity. In general, one of Ezra's major projects is to cease this rampant intermarriage. Every Jew basically returned with Persian wives. And he struggles throughout his career to try to end this terrible, terrible scourge. But he's also very attentive to language. He's a sofer. So he writes Sifrei Torah. In fact, the Gemara in Megillah, I don't know if I quoted the Gemara, Megillah basically sees him as a figure comparable to Moshe Rabbeinu. By the way, if you're interested, everything I've spoken about in the dating of Purim is in Source 5 and 6. Source 5 is the first call of Pesukim in Ezra, and Rashi takes you through the names and the figures of who the kings were and when this happens. So if you take a look at Source number 9, Tanya Rabbi Yossi Omer, Roi Hoya Ezra Shetinasin Tara Al Yado. Ezra was a figure that could have launched or spearheaded a Har Sinai. Il Malei Kadmei Moshe, but Moshe beat him to the punch. But Ezra's like Moshe Rabbeinu. B'Moshe Omer U'Moshe Allah L'Elokim V'Ezra Omer Azra Alami Bavel. B'Moshe Hu Omer, line number 3, V'Yotit Tziva Hashem Be'it Ahi L'Amed Etchem U'V'Ezra Omer Ki Ezra Yechin L'Bavo L'Drosh Et Torat Hashem. V'Af Al Pi, line number 5, Shalom Nitna Tara Al Yado. Even though Tara was not delivered by Ezra, Moshe already delivered the Tara. Nishtaneh Haktav Al Yado. What does this mean, Nishtaneh Haktav Al Yado? Okay, the fonts.
To be the actual script.
Right, the fonts in our Sifrei Torah are called what? Ktav Ashuri. The Aleph, the Bet, the Gimel. Those are not the fonts with which Torah was given. Torah was given at Har Sinai in a Sanskrit-like font with angles and vectors, like a much more primal alphabet. Ezra felt that he had to rebuild language. And part of the way you rebuild languages is introducing different letters. So he converted the ancient Aleph into a more opaque, or decorated. These letters are much richer. They've got crowns on them. They've got different shapes. Basically, in Kabbalah, there's a lot of studying of the letters. Many of the letters are conjugation of other letters. So a hey is a resh and a yud, upside down yud. A tzaddik is a bent nun with a little yud on top. A pe is a kaf with an upside down yud. So you've got a lot of... It's a much more complex and sophisticated language than just simple Sanskrit triangles, backward triangles, more than signs, equal signs, less than signs. And he redoes language. So Moshe Rabbeinu delivers the Torah, Ezra rebuilds language, and of course he was also very involved in Kriyas HaTorah. The current format of Kriyas HaTorah is based on Ezra. The trup, the mangina, not necessarily the tone, the tune, but the punctuation, the cantillation, is Ezra. The pauses in the Pesukim are Ezra. The minhag of reading Targum, which lasted well into the days of the Tanaim and the Amoraim, to actually get up and recite Targum Onkelos alongside of the Torah, was something that Ezra reinstalled after it had been lost for many years. So Ezra's very attentive to language-based identity recovery. How do we recover our identity that was lost based on our... He's the opposite of Mordechai. He's Ezra HaSofer. He rebuilds Hebrew rather than just confusing all the languages into one, or collapsing all the languages into one. So before we even enter the world of Nes Purim and Megillas Esther, it's a lot happening to Am Yisrael over these years. And it's coming to a head right now, because it's in between these two moments of Gula. It's a very, very delicate and tenuous moment. Now, you have to know a little bit of history as well, and then we'll get back to Nes Purim. What you're starting to see two political developments around the time of Megillas Esther. One is, of course, the rapid, rapid succession of kings and empires. Whenever you see political instability in a sustained fashion, you're basically looking at a redemptive era trying to account for itself. History is an accounting. Like before April 15th, the Americans, you got to rush through your taxes and get all your taxes done. When history reaches its terminus, it has to account for itself. So that's why many people feel that we're living in a very, very redemptive era, because the last 200 years, last 150 years, been extremely, extremely unstable. World wars and different types of governments rising and falling, and communism and unrest and instability. And if you take a look at Pesach, the Gula from Mitzrayim, pharaohs ruled for their entire lifetimes, 80 years, 90 years, however long they lived. They weren't easily replaced. Yet in Parsha Shmos, we see at least three pharaohs. We see the paro who's ruling when the story begins. We witness the Melech Chadash, Vayakam Melech Chadash, Asher Lo Yadat Yosef, whoever that new one was. And then Vayamat Melech Mitzrayim, Vayanchu B'nei Yisrael. So within Temsukim, we're seeing three paros. A lot of overhaul. A lot of transitioning. That's what you're seeing in Megillas Esther. Nebuchadnezzar built an empire to last 1,000 years. No one even dared defy him. That's how indomitable he was. That's how fearsome he was. Then his successor, Belshazzar, the entire kingdom falls in a night. It was unspeakable and unimaginable. I lived through the Soviet Union. We thought that would last. We thought it would last forever. Everyone, I grew up in fear. I practiced climbing under my desk because we thought we'd be nuked by the Soviet Union. Literally. I remember being a youngster in Brooklyn, and most of my father's family had escaped before communism became suppressive in the early teens, late teens, 1919, 1920. But there was one part of the family that got stuck in Russia. We always heard about the part of the family that got stuck in Russia and they lost their religion. So I remember the early 70s, one of my family members came to visit us in America. And he was really a Russian communist, part of the party. He came in his uniform, sat at the table in his uniform with his red star, and his name was Boris or something, and I mean, I was shaking and quaking under the table. He'd take out his gun and blow me away, and he talked, Moshe, what are you doing? I was terrified when he spoke to me, and he, I remember he gave me a toy tank. He gave me a little toy tank as a gift, and I brought my tank to school, and it was gears, and like after 2 days, the battery died. So I opened up the back, and I went to replace the battery. It was a Russian battery. It was a square battery. I couldn't replace it because there were no square batteries in my local gift shop. So I just tossed the tank in the garbage. But we were really frightened of the Russians. And then just overnight, 1989, the entire system collapses. Don't be intimidated by human conventions. Humans can't build anything meant to last. They seem that way. It appears to be stable, appears to be overwhelming. Part of being a Jew is that we laugh at the transience of these systems that people build that seem to be unbreakable, seem to be indomitable. I talked about the Russian-Soviet Union. No one thought they could be defeated until Sharansky and a couple of Jews got up and decided, I don't care, I want to go to Israel. And we were the first people to defy the Russian authority. And Sharansky was released in 1986, 1985, and 4 years later, the walls come tumbling down. So it's not coincidental. That's what a Jew is. A Jew stands in the face of whatever human conventions are built that seem to be unbreakable, and we laugh at them because they're paper tigers, because we realize they're Masei De'adam. We just said it this morning in Hallel. They're Masei De'adam. And I am Lam V'lei Ruas. I am Lam V'lei Shema. Af Lam V'lei Richa. We're not overwhelmed. We're not daunted by them. They may seem overwhelming, but we know better because they're just Masei De'adam. So you're seeing a lot of that instability. And then you're seeing a lot of kings rule. Again, it's not clear who the Achashverosh was, but one thing is clear. Then in that 18 or so year period, you have a lot of kings. One stage, you have Koresh and Daryavash and Koresh the second and Daryavash the second and Achashverosh and the whole potpourri of kings. And if you want, you can Google. There are plenty of articles written. Who is Achashverosh? Whose son was he really? Who was his father? Who was his child? But you're seeing in that 18-year period a lot of instability, a lot of kings moving onto the stage, moving off the stage really quickly. The second thing you're seeing, which is even more relevant to the Megillah, and more relevant to the Nais, and more relevant to our conversation, is the emergence of multi-regional global empires. Ashur was the first multi-regional empire. It used to be your empire was limited to your region. Egypt. Powers. All of a sudden, these armies are starting to conquer large swaths of land, and they're getting larger and larger. So Ashur, Sancheirev, enters Israel and basically captures the entire land band, a band of land, let's say more or less from modern-day Iran to Egypt. More or less. And then his successor, Nebuchadnezzar, expands it even broader, more easterly. And then we read in the Megillah, that Achashverosh, Parasimadai, Mehudu Bet Kush, Mea, Vesrim, Vesheva, Medinot, HaMelech Achashverosh, Mehudu Bet Kush. Now, that requires the emergence of a very interesting industry. Postal system. When your empire is region-based, first of all, there's an inborn trust because you're all built out of one ethnicity. There's natural trust you have. But also, you can dispatch couriers to carry your information. 2 days travel, 3 days travel, a month's travel, you'll get there. How far is it to travel on horseback from the northern tip of Egypt to the southern tip of Egypt, from Iran to Israel? More or less, you'll get there. You can't dispatch personal couriers to deliver messages back and forth verbally across the globe. You have to send letters. And you have to assume that those letters will be written well, authoritatively, and will be adhered to at the risk of death. So letter writing is not just scribbling some minutes and some information. It's how will the king's will be enforced and dispatched to all these 127 Medinos, many of whom have never seen the king and have only heard of him. I remember as a youngster, it always bothered me. Remember when Esther and Mordechai are pleading with Achashverosh, please, please, repeal the decree, and Achashverosh gets all formal. I can't really repeal the decree because it was signed with the king's seal. But I'll issue a different decree that the Jews can defend. I said, what's a big deal? Just cancel the decree. It is a big deal. Because people have to know that when the king issues a decree, it is irrevocable. And that decree has to be implemented, period. There could be no turning back. Or else the entire kingdom will disintegrate. The entire authority structure will become brittle. So I can't repeal it because my entire kingdom will collapse. I can issue another decree. The Jews can defend themselves. But I can't repeal the original decree. Because that will ruin the postal infrastructure, the way of communication. Remember I mentioned Nebuchadnezzar? Nebuchadnezzar had his origins. Interestingly enough, he wasn't aristocratic. He wasn't born of privilege. He was a scribe in the Babylonian army. But that was his launching pad for political influence. It'd be like the equivalent of an Israel. So many, fortunately or unfortunately, of the political leaders launch their careers from the army. If you go to the army, you start to wield influence in society. So in Babylonia, the way that you wielded influence is you became a scribe, you became a letter writer. And these letter writers were important cultural political figures. They weren't just, as we imagine, postal carriers carrying mail back and forth. They were artists, and they had to inherit their lot, Achashdran ben Haramachim. That's the backdrop for Megillas Esther. The backdrop for Megillas Esther is, again, we're right in the middle of that stalled redemption, 18 years of stagnancy, somewhere in those 18 years. There's a lot of malaise. Jews are suffering. Why do you think the Jews were punished? The Gemara says in Megillah, look at the Gemara in Megillah, source number 17. Shalu Talmidav, Esrabi Shimon ben Yochai. They asked him, Rebbe, Mipnei ma nischayvu, Sonem shel Yisrael shebaoso hador kloya. Why were the Jews threatened so severely and so harshly? What did they do wrong? We don't see any failure, any chait, any... What happened? Amar lehem, so he told his talmidim, imratem, you tell us. You tell me, what happened? You answer your own question. So they said, Amar lehem ibnei shenenu misudasa shel osa rasha. Because the Jews participated in Achashverosh's meal. What's so criminal about participating in that meal? There are many midrashim that talk about the food being kosher, vashtia, kadas, enones, the food was absolutely kosher. Everyone had their own food. Maybe we'll talk about this a little bit next week. Everyone had their wine, their food, their style of eating. Part of the answer is, well, part of it is moral. I spoke about this last week. How could you spend your time at a 180-day orgy? You go to a party, show up for a day or two. 180 days of eating and vomiting and eating and sexual promiscuity and just acting like savages. And so what, the food's kosher? It's not the question you ask. You don't ask, is the food kosher? You ask, is that a place that I belong? Who do you think was footing the bill for that 180-day party in Shushan? All the poor farmers of the entire 127-kingdom empire, while being taxed through the nose, that a few oligarchs and patriarchs and wannabe celebrities are living it up for 180 days in Shushan. In fact, when Esther is appointed, finally the tax is eased a little bit, the tax burden, because she brings a little bit of moral relief, not just, because Esther stands for something a little different. It'll be taxed through it. So part of it is, regardless of when you're living, you shouldn't be at that party. But part of it is, it's one thing not to move to Israel. Listen up, girl. There are Jews dying in Israel as Purim is unfolding in Shushan. It's nothing not to move. And sadly enough, only 42,000 Jews moved with Ezra. Had more Jews moved, history would have been very different. Had every single Jew returned during the days of Ezra, you'd all be Israeli. There'd be no Tinek. There'd be no Spain. There'd be no Poland. Chazal say Mashiach was ready to happen. That would have been the kingdom of Mashiach. History would have closed. And the Gemara Megillah is direct. It says the reason the second Beis HaMikdash never got traction is because only 42,000 Jews returned. I think we're making the same mistake in our day, unfortunately. So the Jews living and dying in Israel, defending our land, it's not that you're not there, but you're just sitting there partying your life away, endlessly indulging in a Achashverosh's party when Jews are dying in Shushan. In Israel, in Yerushalayim. There's nothing wrong with the party per se, aside from its moral components, but also, if you're just suffering in Israel, go join them. If you don't join them, at least don't sit there and pleasure yourself and eat all day and relax and luxuriate when people are dying and suffering. So that's part of the backdrop. Part of the backdrop is the deculturalization of the Jews, as evidenced by the loss of language. And part of it is the emergence of letter writing and the importance of letter writing and the letter carriers. Now, as I mentioned before, your homework is to find the 10 letters. But trust me that each and every letter was translated, because otherwise it couldn't be read. So it had to be translated. That's, again, part of the craft. The letter writers were not just writing the letters, but translating them to the various languages. So, for example, source number 12, the first letter. Vayishlach Sfarim El Kol Medinos Hamelech El Medina Umedina Kichtava V'el Am Va'am Kilshono Lios Kol Ish Sarer Beveso Umedaber Kilshonamo. Every letter is translated. And not just the neutral letters of Megillas Esther, but even the harsh letters of Megillas Esther, the tragic letters of Megillas Esther, the ominous letters of Megillas Esther, they're also translated so that all the anti-Semites know the day they're allowed to kill the Jews. So, for example, source number 13, Vayomer Melech Laman, Hakesef Natun Lecha, take your money, I don't want your money, I'll commit genocide on my own free will, I'm thrilled to do it. Vayikaru, here we see again the drama. Read source 13 with me. Sofrei ha-melech b'chodesh rishon, vayikasev, k'chol asher tziva haman, elach hashdar p'nei ha-melech, v'el pachos, hashel medina medina, v'el sarei ambam, medina medina, kichtava. Every empire had it translated. Ambam kilshono. Every nation had it translated. B'shem ha-melech ha-chashverosh nechtav, v'nechtam b'tabas ha-melech, the official insignia, the royal seal, except for one language. Which language do you think all these letters weren't translated into? Hebrew. Hebrew. Because there's no need to, because no one speaks it anymore. And I'll prove it to you in a moment, don't worry. Take me on trust, okay? Whenever I think about the Holocaust, I think about Jews who didn't speak the languages of the Germans or the Ukrainians. I think about the Dutch Jews and the French Jews and being shipped into a concentration camp, and it's scary enough, and the dogs are barking in the middle of the night, you're being separated from your family, you're starving, you're ill, you're sick, you're coughing, and you don't even understand the languages. And you just, these letters were being distributed amongst 127 Medinos, and the Gentiles are parting it up and sharpening their blades and taking out their cannons, and the Jews literally don't know what hit them because they can't even read the letters, and they have to go to their kind Gentile friends, they, what does this letter mean? And the guy says, well, I think my bubby told me. My bubby? Yeah. He lived in Germany right before the war, and very wealthy. And I think she never saw her parents. I don't know, did her mother take her? I forget the exact story. But the story when she left was one day she was walking home, and then their neighbors, who they've been best friends with, they've been, you know, kind, sweet, and friendly neighbors, walked by one day and went like this to my bubby. I had a basket, made it some motion that her head would be in a basket the next day. And everybody told me that her mother or her sister or something, we have to get out of here now. She went over to your guy's friend and said, what does the letter say? He says, you'll be killed in a few months. So this is the nadir of Jewish history, where we become so decultured that we're executed and threatened. They don't even bother to translate into Jewish, in Jewish language. Just, no one's speaking Jewish language. So it's just our execution is just like a natural continuation of our deculturalization. We've lost the Mikdash, we've lost our home, we've lost our identity, and why shouldn't we be? And then the miracle happens. Then Hashem rehabilitates us. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu restores our identity by saving us. And that identity, this is the thesis of today's Shir, girls. Purim creates the thrust to bring it home, to take us out of that stagnant, stalled stage and create that second stage of Gula. That's why Purim is so important. Purim is not just some isolated miracle somewhere in the middle of nowhere that Jews are saved. It is pitched within a historical context, a struggling for redemption, failing to participate fully in redemption and spending our time in Achashverosh's party, feeling that we're reaching the lowest possible level, that even our extinction letters aren't translated to Hebrew, and then being redeemed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Part of that redemption is physical, material, we're saved. Part of it is also linguistic. Now all of a sudden, we have a home. We have a God. We have a protector. We have a future. We have an identity. We have a language. That first letter, after the redemption, source number 14. Vayikaru, Safrei HaMelech, this is Parches, the letter to liberate the Jews, to allow them to defend. Look at this pasuk, it's a beautiful pasuk. Bechodesh HaShlishi, Chodesh Sivan, when is the letter written to Sivan? It's our month. Bishloshev Yesrim Bo, Vayikasev, Kachal HaShet Sivan, Mordechai, El HaYudim, Be'el HaShtar Panim, the same letter carriers, the same rock stars, Apachos, Rehem Medinos, Shem Yehudu Ver Kush, Shev Yesrim Yesrim Medina, 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 Kichtava, Am Va'am Kil Shono. Who wants to read the last couple words of the Pesukim? Now they're writing letters in Hebrew. Before, and they weren't, because those were letters of tragedy and destruction and Jewish demise and Jewish disappearance. Because the ark before this letter was an ark of total annihilation of the Jewish people, materially, culturally, historically. So why bother to write letters in Hebrew? But now the Jewish people are surging, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu has redeemed and provided the national thrust, the national identity. So now language matters, and Hebrew language matters, and now everything will be translated to Hebrew. You have to be able to see Megillas Esther, Nes Purim, in its historical context. It's not just some distant miracle in a vacuum. It is part of the struggle of redemption, and the metaphor for that struggle is the struggle for language, the struggle for Hebrew. Remember I said the first six chapters of Ezra are written in Aramaic, and the seventh chapter on, when they get back to Israel, it's written in Hebrew. Same transition from Aramaic into Hebrew. My hidden message, girls, is speak in Hebrew. A little ironic. Okay, so even though the shiur is a little English, but one of the accomplishments you should take with you from this year, even if you don't stay in Israel, is you should feel that part, I can't say this enough, part of being an Oved Hashem is speaking Hebrew. You have to be the next Agnon. You have to be the next Chernokhovsky. Speak Hebrew. At least know how to speak it. It's our language. It's our Torah. It's our language. That's the struggle of Purim. Remember I mentioned before, Daniel? You ever see it at Chazal? He didn't write it down on some of the Makaros. Always trying to find a place for Daniel in Megillas Esther. Anyone know who Daniel was? Which person in Megillas Esther do Chazal associate with Daniel most often? What? Charvona. Charvona is a Daniel. You know who Charvona was? Charvona was the person who came in Perek Vav and formed Haman and that Haman's tree. All of a sudden, this Charvona comes out of nowhere. I had the clear blue. This guy named Charvona shows up. That's Daniel. Some say Hasach, the person who was kind to Esther. Chagai, just all these minor personalities in the Megillah. Chazal said, oh, that was Daniel. That was Daniel. That was Daniel. Why are we looking for a place for Daniel? The answer is because Daniel was the first. The first person to understand that Jewish identity is not just Mikdash, but Jewish identity is how we eat and how we speak, and he stood tall. The beginning of Daniel, he is one of those young leaders that are transported to Nebuchadnezzar's palace. And as part of Nebuchadnezzar's acculturation strategy, he wants them to eat the fine foods of the palace, and he gives them food, and it's all kosher food. But Daniel says, I'm not eating your food, I'm Jewish. I refuse to allow you to neuter my culture. So what does he eat? Anyone know Daniel? Rad Zraim. He asks some of the guards to smuggle in Zraim seeds. That is, girls, that is the most authentic and first source for Aznei Haman, for Hamadasha. Because the first Aznei Haman were made from seeds, from perek, poppy seeds. And the Ramah says, Shulchan Aruch, this is not some pshat, this is the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch, that we eat Aznei Haman on Purim to remember Daniel's seeds. Because they were high in protein, they smuggled in. Why are we trying to remember Daniel on Purim by eating Hamantashen to remember Daniel? It wasn't ever in Shushan. This Chazal saw a direct line from Daniel's heroism in the beginning of Sefer Daniel to the revival of Jewish identity, which is heralded and punctuated to the next Purim. And that's why they're trying to find a place for Daniel in Megillas Esther. Not just to eat Aznei Haman to remember him, but trying to find a place for him in Megillas Esther. Where is he? He's got to be there somewhere, whether it's literal or not. But he's got to be in the Megillah somewhere. That's why Megillas Esther isn't just called a Sefer. It's called an Igeres. To capture the metaphoric role of letters and language in Megillas Esther. The letters encapsulated the loss of language because all the letters were written. And the letters aren't iconic like Snapchat or Instagram. Letters are the iconic technology of the day. What happens on those fronts and in those realms shape human experience, shape human identity. And when letters aren't being written in Hebrew, it matters because letters are the up-and-coming tech of the day. It's the tech of the day. It would be the equivalent of saying today's internet, you can write in internet any language you want but Hebrew. Of course, it's all English when it's translated. But let's say you couldn't write Hebrew on the internet. It would mean that Hebrew is not a recognized language. Letters not being written in Hebrew means that Hebrew is antiquated. It's obsolete. The Jewish people have lost their historical meaning. They're out. And then they revive. And Sefer Ezra turns into Hebrew. And then they revive in the letters of redemption from Parachet onwards. They're all written in Hebrew. Ve'el ha'yudim kichtavam b'chil shonam. And not only is language revived and letters translated into Hebrew, but our good friend Mordechai, again, these are all Midrashim. Our good friend Mordechai becomes a master of Hebrew, and his arc turns towards being able to. Remember, we talked about Mordechai, who got all those languages confused, and well, not confused, but was mixing languages. He's called Mordechai Bilshan. So they get back to Israel, the Gemara in Menachos says. It's source number Samach Dalet Amud Beis. See, one of the hard things about being an immigrant, about being an Olah, So when I go on Tiolim, my kids really know the country better than I do. To know the country, you have to grow up here or become a Madrich Sior. You have to know these where the Nachal is and where the Har is. It's not natural to me. In fact, I was living a couple of years ago, in 2014, about 4.5 years ago, during that very, very terrible summer with the boys who were kidnapped. And so a story that a lot of people don't know about is the army was trying to find the bodies, and they couldn't. And then at about 18 days, 17 days into the process, the local tour guides came to the army, the Madrichei Sior. They said, let us take over. And these tour guides, they literally know the landscape stone by stone, mountain range by mountain range. And they discover the bodies. I don't know if you're old enough to remember. The bodies were buried under olive trees, but the olive trees had been planted there on top of the bodies to camouflage the location. So if you were just an average soldier looking around, you'd see olive trees and you'd move on. But they know the land. They knew the land so well that he has something off about the way those olive trees are lodging and standing, and that's how they got to the bodies. They could have been years. They just would have looked for it on their own. So they're back in Israel, and now it's Pesach time. And they need to know where the barley ripens first. But two generations have lived outside of Israel. If you lived in Israel, you know, oh, go to the Bikkah. That's where the first crops ripen. Or go up to the Golan, and that's where you'll get the good grapes. We don't know that. We're coming from America. Who would know these things? So it's Pesach, and they're in a panic because they have to find barley. Source number 11. Maisa Sheba Omer. Kimata Omer Lohaviyah Demei Chai Se Omer. They didn't know line number 2, where to find the barley. It's the beginning of this is right now. Let's say now is Pesach. I mean, it's a Shana Muber, but if not, Pesach will be right now. Where do you find barley? Right now. It's freezing outside. So they put out an announcement. Who can help us find barley? A man came by, and the problem was he was deaf and mute, but he knew where it was. He was mute, I'm sorry. So he couldn't speak. So he played charades. So what he did was, he put his hand, one hand on the roof, and one hand on a hut. And they're saying, Gag Tzrif, Gag Tzrif, Tzrif Gag, Gagot Tzrifin, which is the location. They ran to Gagot Tzrifin, they found the barley. Now it's 7 weeks later, and they need wheat for the Shtei HaLechem, because on Shavuot we offer the carbon Shtei HaLechem, it has to be from new wheat. They don't know where the new wheat can be found. So they put out an announcement, where should we go? Same mute person came along, didn't know how to say it, so he put one hand on his eye, and he put one hand on the plug of the water, it's called a secher, where the water was plugged in. Secher, ein secher, ein secher. They ran to ein secher, and they found the wheat. Here was a guy that knew language and topography better than anyone else. The Gemara Menachah says that was Mordechai. That man, the Gemara Menachah says, was Mordechai. Now, why he was mute, it's hard to know, but here you have Mordechai transforming from someone who's got all these languages in his head to someone that's the expert in Hebrew and is able to teach people where to find wheat and barley in the land of Israel. So, what I want you to see is two things. I want you to be able to sense the historical impact of Nes Purim and Megillas Esther and the metaphor of language and letters to help us trace the fall of Jewish identity and of Jewish language, and then the resurgence of Jewish identity and Jewish language through this vehicle of letter writing. And that's why Megillas Esther is deformalized, al pi halacha. It's a little bit of a sefer, but we want to capture the historical moment, the historical period of letter writing, because the letters highlighted to people the Jewish culture and Jewish identity is being restored. Okay? I'm going to go to Mincha now. It's Rosh Chodesh, I want to miss Mincha. Next week, we'll talk about the morality of Megillas Esther. Like, how many? Talk about 10 letters, there are also 10 parties. That's your double homework. Find the 10 letters and find the 10 parties. So, why were there 10 parties? And what does that teach us about how to party, not how to party? Everyone's going to come, right? 10 steps to partying. Baruch Atah Adonai.